Ran over. I'm Emma Loosely and I'm in art history, but I'm coming to talk to you all about the School of Arts, Histories and Cultures. And in case you hadn't realised, I've brought two willing volunteers from art history, or maybe not so willing, Lucy and Andy, who are here to answer questions you have of current PhD students so that you can get the reality of the situation and not just perhaps the rose-tinted spectacle the staff give you. So the first thing I have to do, and it's really important because Stuart Jones has been nagging me about this, is to remind you that at 3 o'clock this afternoon, in room 202 of the Mansfield Cooper building, there will be a lecture about funding. So I'm not going to go into PhD funding in this session because I want to use this session for other matters, because there will be, it's very important, an hour's lecture by Stuart, 3 o'clock, Mansfield Cooper, room 202. After that, from 4 till 5 this afternoon, all of those of us who are subject postgraduate directors will be sat in our offices around the campus for a drop-in hour. So you can actually go and talk to the representative of the subject area that you are interested in on a one-to-one basis. You don't have to make an appointment, you just turn up and ask them questions between 4 and 5. And we're anticipating that a lot of the questions will be related to the issue of funding. So that's why I know funding tends to be like the big thing. I'm not going to go specifically into funding in this session because it's going to be dealt with at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Right, so, yes. It is all on the university intranet. The School of Arts, Histories and Cultures intranet has all that information. Or alternatively, you should go and see your subject area postgraduate director in their office hours or by appointment, because you, only the person who works in that subject can tell you what is available in that area, because studentships and bursaries vary from subject to subject according to the size and number of students, how much they're allocated in terms of funds. So, for example, I could only tell you what bursaries we have available for art historians, but I couldn't tell you for history or English, for example. So if you can't make it and you can't find the relevant thing on the website, go and see the person who's postgraduate director for your subject area. Any more questions at this stage? Brilliant. So the purpose today is to basically tell you how to prepare, because the deadlines you need to get into your mind right now are that you have to apply by the 15th of February for a PhD if you want to be eligible to apply for funding as well. Now, if you want to apply for a PhD and you're not applying for funding in any way, you can apply all through the year. But if you're actually wanting to go for any kind of scholarship, you have to be organised enough to get your official application in by the 15th of February. And this is what you need to bear in mind. Also think about this now, because you will need, for that application, to have the agreement in principle of a supervisor. We'll be moving on to that in a moment. But the big thing that needs time is you will need two academic references. And I'm aware you're all on MA programs now, so you should all know at least two members of staff that theoretically you can approach, or if you've come from an undergraduate degree recently, then you can ask someone as well who taught you as an undergraduate. But bear in mind that academics, like everyone else, have Christmas and New Year holidays. And so it's quite good to kind of alert them now to the fact you're going to be wanting a reference by that date so that they can get it done. Sort of getting hold of them in late January and saying, I need a reference by kind of next week, never goes down well. And if you want your references to be glowing, it's better to get the people in a good mood. So as an academic, I would say at this stage, remember, give them notice and also give them as much information as you can. You would be amazed how many students who want references to go on to study further or want a job just say, hi, remember me, I want a reference. We need a breakdown of your undergraduate scores and some indication, if you have any indication so far from kind of summative rather than formative feedback. If you've been given some idea on how you're doing, if you've done a presentation or something at some level of your MA so far, any indicative indication is good, even though we understand it's very early in your MA career to know exactly where you're at. What work experience you've done, what kind of research you're doing, what you're interested in. We need as much information from you as possible in order to make our references strong for you. The more we know about your past grades, your interests and things, the more we can write about you as a rounded human being. So if a staff member comes back to you and says, yes, I'll write a reference, but I need an awful lot more from you, they're not doing it to torture you. They're doing it because they're saying that they're going to write you a detailed reference with as much information as possible. So that's one thing. So kind of going back, the first thing I think I'm covering here is references. To apply for a PhD and or funding, you need 2 academic references. Now that's the easy bit. The other thing you need that I've just mentioned in passing is the in-principle agreement of a supervisor. Now you can apply to a university anywhere in the world to a subject area without contacting a person, but general applications like that have a much, much higher rejection rate than cases where a person has targeted an individual member of staff that they are interested in and actually started a dialogue with them in advance. The majority of PhD students have done some research on the internet or going and talking, if it's someone, they're at Manchester already and they want to stay at Manchester, going along in the office hour and talking to a member of staff and saying, look, I'm interested in this. Is this something you would be interested in supervising? If it's not your area, can you recommend me someone who is in this particular academic area and would make a good supervisor? And you talk to them and you build up a relationship before putting in a formal application. So if those of you, and well, I'm hoping those of you here today are thinking of doing a PhD, how many of you have already started to think about someone who might be a suitable supervisor? Quite a few of you, that's really good. Because what you really need to do is go and talk to that person and get an in-principle agreement that it, you know, they would theoretically have the space and have the interest in taking you on. Because it is we're not supposed to have more than 6 PhD students at any one time. So it may be that the person you want to work with is already full up. And they may say, I'd love to have you, but I can't make room for you. Or if you could come next year when a couple of people graduated, I've got room then. You really need to kind of check these things out. Also, if the person says, I've got lots on, but I can make room for you, you have to start thinking, that's all very well, but is this person really going to have the time to devote to me? It's got to be a two-way process. It's not just about them interviewing you, it's about you interviewing them to a certain extent, to make sure that you think you can have a working relationship with this person, that you're compatible and you're going to be able to work closely together for at least 3 years. So it really is something you need to put a lot of thought into. You need to actually have several chats with a person and think, you know, is this going to work? Now, when you have got to that stage, presumably you've all got an idea in your head about what it is you would like to research. You now have to go away and use your Christmas holiday. I know you're all going to have your MA work as well, but unfortunately I'm just about to give you quite a bit more work. You have to use your Christmas holiday to do a bit of research, because you have to establish that nobody has actually done what it is that you want to do in future, and to the best of your knowledge, that there is no research project or individual at the moment researching that area, because your PhD is supposed to be totally unique and it's meant to be something that has never, ever been done before. Now, my own research was looking at a group of monuments that had only been looked at in the 1950s by an archaeologist and only been looked at in the 1990s by someone who studied the liturgy. And I decided to be the first person to mix archaeology and church history and look at how these things were used, because people had taken them from one discipline and from another and never put them together. Lucy, who's sat here, I hope you don't mind me saying, managed during her master's research to find an object, a very important 6th century object, probably 6th century, not quite sure, that had never been studied by anyone before, even though it's in a collection at the Vatican and is actually historically very significant. So her PhD is the first research on this 6th century reliquary. And yours is the first on artists, isn't it? And you look at artist studios.
Still
unique. And so Anne is taking a new look at how artists use their studio space. So you need to do quite a bit of reading around the subject. I needed to make sure no one had taken the same approach to my group of churches. Lucy had to make sure no one had written an article or a book on her reliquary box. And Andy had to look at how people wrote about artists and their use of space. So you need to go away and make sure that if you're doing something that's quite well known, that you are taking a totally new approach to it, and you have made every effort you can that no one else is replicating that research or doing anything too similar to it. Because the point of a PhD is to add to our sum of knowledge in a particular subject. It's to come up with something that's original, that's never been done before, and it's part of your job, or is your job really, at this stage, to make sure what you're doing is unique. Because at the end of the PhD process, you are theoretically the person in the world who knows the most about that subject. There shouldn't be anyone else on the planet who knows more about your chosen subject than you, which means I'm the expert on a very, very obscure form of ritual in 4th century Syria. And they're not always useful pieces of information. They are to a few, but not to many. I mean, you may find that there are about 5 people in the world who care at the end of your research, but you have added something to the general sum of knowledge. That's what you're aiming for. So, over Christmas, you need to take your general idea and you need to read around the subject and you need to be looking for the gaps. Which are the bits that are missing? Which are the bits that I'd like to really know more about, but there doesn't seem to be anything written on? Those are the areas you should be going towards. And then you need to start thinking about the proposal. Now, you can use, and in fact, it's highly recommended that you use your supervisor or your prospective supervisor to advise you on this. But if you are going for funding, and even if you're not, PhD proposal is really important. Now, we are not going to hold you to exactly what you write, because obviously research is an unknown quantity. You don't know where, you may start at A and end up at B, having gone via Z to get there. Because you go down so many blind alleys in research. You don't know what's going to work out and what isn't. So we don't mind if it evolves, but obviously you shouldn't start by saying, I want to do 12th century crusading history and end up with, I don't know, the history of the Manchester Ship Canal at the end. We want, it's got to be the same basic area you started out with. We can't have you chopping and changing completely, but we understand if it evolves. What you need for that proposal at this stage is to be able to coherently outline what the main research question or questions are that you are proposing to look at, and then to outline the methodology that you are going to follow to answer those questions. We do not want a descriptive, postmodern stream of consciousness type of work, which I have had from people who think they're going to do performance studies or something and feel they have to approach it like a performance. It's got to be solid scholarship. By that I mean you should make reference to the literature as it stands now. You should talk about, and maybe you've only got a few A4 pages. How many is it? 2? I think 2 A4 pages? Yes. If you're going for AHRC funding or something like that, you've got about 1,000 words, or between 1,000 and 1,500, if I remember correctly. It's very strictly enforced. So you've basically got 2 sides of A4 to get this into. You need to make reference to the classic figures in the field, obviously, that you're aware of those, and the latest research. How what you're doing is new and innovative and hasn't been done before. What it is that is unique about your piece of work. And as I say, you should make it clear that you are aware of the literature. You also need to put in a basic time frame. You have 3 years. You should be saying, well, you know, most all PhDs start with a literature search and bibliographical research at the beginning. But if you need extensive periods of field work, that's normally undertaken in the second year. You need to outline where in the world you need to travel, how long you need to be there. Now, if you're going to be doing research and using archives, you need to mention which archives you're going to and how long you're going to be spending in them. It's no good saying, well, I need to spend 6 months in one in Australia, and then, you know, another 3 months in one in Russia, and another 5 months in one in Peru. It has to be something that can be done realistically as a three-year project. And you have to think about the financial implications as well. How are you going to pay for this? Even if you've got a full studentship, it's going to be very, very expensive to be jetting all over the world and spending months somewhere else. You have to think about what kind of studentships and scholarships you're eligible for, how you will fund extensive periods in exotic locations, if that's what it requires. And as I say, although it's 3 years of research, you have to think how it's going to fit into the overall structure, because as a rule of thumb, generally the first year is spent in Manchester doing reading, and by Manchester I mean based in Manchester, but maybe travelling all over the country, going to different libraries and collections. In the second year, you tend to spend any period you need overseas, and then the third year is spent writing up. You know, you really need in your third year to have broken the backbone of the research and only have a few bits of snagging left and spend that year writing. So it has to fit roughly into those three kind of tiers, as it were, each third mapped out neatly. Because again, what if you're going for funding in particular, what is looked at is if this is a project that is feasibly feasibly fits in 3 years. One problem we have with a lot of PhD students is that they come in thinking they're going to write, you know, the masterwork, the be-all and end-all in their field. And you have to explain to people there is an 80,000 word limit on a PhD thesis. You can't do more than 80,000 words. And you are not writing your magnum opus. You are starting. It's baby steps. And it's a massive thing, and getting a PhD is an absolutely massive thing. But if you go on to academia, you realise afterwards it's the start, it's not the end. So you shouldn't be thinking to write the definitive world history of shoes, for example. You should be perhaps looking at just the rise and fall of Manolo Blahnik or something like that. You know, you have to be completely specific. You have to choose just whatever you're interested in, choose one bite-sized piece, rather than trying to do the whole thing all in one go. It's about judging what is feasible. And that's quite hard. It's hard in the sense that almost everybody wants to do something enormous. But that's good, because for a supervisor, cutting things down is the easy part. Trying to make something out of nothing is impossible. So someone coming to you with lots of dreams and ideas is great. You have to get them to rein them in. But someone who comes with kind of something that's really tiny, then there's not much you can do to help them. Again, these are the things you need to be discussing with someone who knows about your area. Someone who can say to you, that's quite a well-trodden path, but if you kind of look at this, start reading about that, that's new. This is where you need a specialist to really steer you into what's relevant and not. Now, at that point, I'm going to take a breath and say, are there any questions at this stage? There's got to be some, surely. No? Yes. Excellent.
Kind of interdisciplinary things like a PhD, can you have more than one supervisor?
You can, yes. Actually, that's a really good question. We have in SARC, and it will soon be this soon, the super school, which I think is going to be called SALC. Is that right? School of Arts, Linguistics and Cultures, when we go in with the School of Languages next year. We have a system, both of us, that you have a panel, a research panel of three people. You have a lead supervisor, second supervisor, and then you have a third person who's called the advisor. Now, the first and second supervisor, between the student and themselves, decide who's the lead and who's the second, because it always has to have one person who takes slightly more responsibility. But that can be anything from kind of 60-40 down to 90-10 in terms of responsibility on a sliding scale as to whether one person is majorly responsible and one person takes less input, or whether it's pretty much of a muchness. So the panel does not have to be made up of people from the same subject area. You could have people from three different subject areas on your panel. You're registered in the department where your primary supervisor is based. So your classification will be related to that of your primary supervisor. But in reality, the interdisciplinary team can be made up of any mixture, depending on your subject and what people think is relevant. So for example, I teach Middle Eastern art and architecture. So I have worked a lot with people who I've been on panels for, and I have people on panels for me who come from Middle Eastern studies. My work also encompasses archaeology. So I work with people from archaeology, I've worked with people from museology, history. I have quite a wide circle of people who I've been on their panels and they're on mine. So that isn't an issue. It just is between you and your primary supervisor as to how you negotiate the percentages of that. But that is encouraged, and it's even theoretically possible, although slightly more difficult because the financial implications become quite complicated, to link with someone from another part of the Faculty of Humanities, for example, anthropology or something in social sciences. So that shouldn't be a problem. Any more questions? Gosh. Any practical questions about applying? About motivation. The one thing I think I should say is this time last year I had two MA students come to me and say to me, should we do a PhD or not? Now, that is impossible to answer, especially in the current financial situation. I said to them, just to be totally honest, I can't guarantee what the world is going to be like in 3 or 4 years' time when you finish. I can't tell you whether there's going to be job opportunities or not. What I can say is there's only one reason for doing a PhD, and that's nothing to do with careers or anything else. It's a feeling that you really, really want to find out about this topic, and that you love studying, and if you don't do it, you will regret it in the future. Forget about financial gain. I've been told by many people it actually sends your earning capacity down if you have a PhD. So don't do it for material reasons. But if you love learning, you love your subject, then go ahead and do it. And you have to love it. I'm telling you this right now, because there are times that however passionate you are about your subject, you will hate it. You will think, why the hell am I doing this? I've made a big mistake. So you have to have a real passion for it at the outset. Otherwise, you will never get to the end of the road. It's got to be kind of a burning thing within you. I love this. I so want to find more about this. Because that is the most important reason for doing a PhD, I think. So I would say to you, if you're wishy-washy, go away and think about it a bit more. But if you have that passion, really, just because you love studying and you love learning, and it's an end in itself, then definitely, I think, go for it. That's the most honest thing I can say. All I can say is that both those girls ended up doing PhDs. They're now in towards the end of their first semester, and they're both saying, we're really glad we did, we're having a whale of a time, and we've made the right choice. That's the only thing I can kind of give you as guidance. It's really tough to know what to say, but the people who have decided to take it on, as far as I know, I've not yet met anyone who has said, this is a terrible mistake and dropped out. But that's all I can kind of go on for that. Yes?
To go along with that.
Yeah.
I guess the career opportunities. I mean, I know you said you can't know what's going to happen. You're not.
Yeah, I can't.
but I've heard that very few people actually become like academics after having a PhD, and that there are not that many jobs in, say, teaching at a university.
It depends where you are, which country you are, how fussy you are, what kind of scholarship you've got. I mean, of my three graduated PhDs, two of them have jobs, one as academics. One was on a government scholarship from his country, and it meant he had to go back and teach for 7 years in his country, whether he wanted to or not, to pay off the debt. So that was tied up. But another one, another student, he I can say he's Turkish, and Turkey is an emerging market. They're opening up a lot of new private universities that want to teach in English. So the fact that he was a native Turk who had studied in England, he was actually sought out by a new research university and said, right, as soon as your viva voce is done, you've got a job made. Because, and I've heard of a number of people finding jobs in Turkey because it's a growing market. You're asking me to be an expert on the world financial situation, and I just can't do that. And I can't blanket say, because as I say, just as I know there are job opportunities in, say, Iran, where my first student is now lecturing, or Turkey, where this other student is now lecturing, my third student who's graduated is Greek, and she has no chance of finding a job because it's Greece and there's nothing happening in Athens, which is why I'm saying it's very much regional. It depends where you come from, where you want to go. So I'm not saying that there are no jobs out there. I'm just saying that a lot of it comes down to where you want to be at the end of the day. And as I say, if you are prepared to go and live in Turkey, the chances are, happy to teach in English, the chances are you'll find a job, because I know quite a few people going there and finding work right now. There are opportunities, for example, I know people getting jobs in Qatar, in the UAE, places like that, Dubai, because they're opening up new institutions. It rather depends whether people want to stay in Europe, North America, or whether they're prepared to go somewhere a long way away to find work. And I think it's always been like that. One of my contemporaries works in a liberal arts college in Connecticut now, and she initially started looking in the UK, decided to go to the States instead, and is incredibly happy. Academia, you have to be aware that you're looking at a global job market, not just one place. The more flexible you are about where you'll go, the more likely you are to find a job. I just happened to find one in the UK, but I work in the Middle East, and I was considering places like Beirut and Cairo and all sorts, but it just so happened that the first job I got offered was in Manchester. The more flexible you are, the more likely you can find work is all I can really say about that. I don't know if that helps you. And by your accent, you're from the States, and there are so many regional colleges. I've got an American student who's looking at the moment, and there are loads of places she can apply because she's prepared to apply to community colleges and liberal arts colleges and so on. Whereas if people are only prepared to apply to state universities or Ivy League, then of course they're limiting the pool. I think the thing is, if you're prepared to be flexible, you will find a job eventually. It might take a while, but you'll get there if you're persistent. But if you're only prepared to stay in one area, or you're only prepared to go with a particular grade of college, then, don't think it's going to happen necessarily. Or you might be lucky, but then again, you might not be. Does that help? I can tell you, it's depressing. It is hard to get jobs, but we are seeing a number of people trickling through. There is movement. We have a lot of postdoctoral students at Manchester, which is a great jumping off point. We're very strong in winning postdoctoral research grants, which is that jumping off point to get a person to write a book. Because once you've got a book, you're infinitely more employable as an academic. You have to get published. And so postdoctoral fellowships are a really good way of doing that. And there are quite a few of them around at the moment. I'm trying to be positive here. Any more questions at this stage? Yeah. Depends what the PhD is in. What's your subject? Or what will be your subject?
English literature at the moment. But I mean in general.
All right. Hi, how are you? Sorry, this is an ex-student of mine. I thought he was coming to listen. Email me at some point. That would be great. Okay. email me and we'll arrange something. You have to think laterally, to be honest. you have to think laterally. You don't just view it as your subject. I think a lot of people think, I've studied, say, English, and my job has to be directly related to English. I always think of a friend of mine who got a PhD in art history at Leipzig University in Germany. Very prestigious, was one of the places. Her PhD topic I thought was fascinating, but was relatively obscure. It was early 20th century typefaces and how it moved from Bauhaus type towards Gothic with the rise of Nazism, and how you could chase political ideologies through changing typefaces. So we're talking something that's quite specialised, and I find fascinating, but not wildly out there in terms of, you know, applicability. We met when I was doing temping at an auction house. She worked at the auction house for a few years, travelled the world, when babysitting a violin to South Africa was one of her adventures. I had to sit on the seat next to her because it was worth hundreds of thousands. You know, all that kind of thing, but they didn't pay very much. So she's now a merchant banker for Goldman Sachs, earning more money in a year than I'd probably see in a decade. So I think you have to be quite flexible. You can be quite flexible. It will go as far as you want it to go. You just have to learn to think about the skills you're getting and where those skills can be applied to another job. You know, the kind of research skills, her knowledge that she gained from doing the PhD. Then she gained knowledge of different markets through working in the art industry. She also learned how to network and deal with sort of different financial systems and things, moved into working for Goldman Sachs. So there, you know, there are ways. If you're creative, it can be used to all sorts of things. And, you know, quite a few commercial organisations quite like to have someone with a PhD. I think it lends a bit of gravitas, you know, to say Dr. So-and-so. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're giving up your desire to become an actuary or a merchant banker or something by doing a PhD. You just have to learn to play on the skills you've gathered. I really don't think you have to be tied down by the subject and think that, you know, that is what I'm going to do. If you would like this 3 years to do the research and really enjoy it, then go for it, do it. But it doesn't stop you going off and doing something else afterwards if you want to. Just don't think you can become a heart surgeon if you have a PhD in history. You know, it's a case of being realistic. But, you know, I hope that helps a bit.
But what I meant was a PhD isn't kind of something in itself. Like, for example, there's some jobs you can only get with a degree. It's not jobs you can get with a PhD. It's more one.
Well, you can only become an academic with a PhD these days. The old system where you could become an academic with a master's degree is now dead. If you want an academic job, you have to have a PhD. It's a prerequisite. If you are wanting to go into certain areas of research, scientific research, social studies, things like that, if you wanted to work for a think tank, for example, then there will be positions, I suspect, will only be open to those who have a PhD in a certain thing, you know. Lobbying, focus groups, all that kind of thing helps if you have a PhD in the area in which you want to be involved in, yeah. I hope that, does that clarify enough? Any other questions? Well, at this point, I'm going to put the spotlight on Lucy and Andy because I've been talking long enough and I think it would be quite good for you to ask questions of people who are current PhDs about what the life is like. So, you two, I'm afraid you'll have to hold this to your mouth as you speak. But basically, any general questions you've got, throw at these two or ask them to start them off.
So, hi, I'm Andy.
And I'm Lucy. Hello.
Okay, so has anyone got any questions? I'm just answering this guy's question before. We do have like a program of complementary studies as well, like arts methods at Manchester, and there's like a lot of career advice and, you know, presentation advice, how to present yourself, you know, to the wider world, so to other industries as well. And there's like a big emphasis at the moment on widening participation and taking like academic knowledge out of the academy and into like more general public. So you do get to see.
How to get an academic job is one of the things.
Yeah.
To answer your question, how to make yourself employable within an academic
context. There's a lot of professionalisation that goes on, you know, with these contextual studies. So you'll find yourself getting skills in other things, you know, how to present yourself, how to, you know, become a professional academic. So.
And also, I think it's quite important to remember to to not put too much pressure on what's going to happen at the end of the of your work or your 3 years as a researcher. Just see it as a, you know, as a way of it possibly opening a few more doors that might not have been there beforehand or without the PhD. You know, I'm in my third year now, and I realise that, you know, at the end of the 3 or 4 years, I'm going to have to try and get a job somewhere. But I just hope that it's something that I enjoy rather than down a specific route. You know, it doesn't have to be academic as such. Just something that centres around art in some way. You know, and I think a lot of people in our department certainly feel that way as well.
Yeah. And you've got like a 3-year opportunity to like look at something that you're really interested in. So you just got to always see it as an opportunity. I mean, you obviously got to do all your work, but it's a chance to reflect on what you actually want to do with your time. Has anyone got any other questions? I have another answer to your other question. Because I'm in art history department, but I have co-supervisors, one in English and American studies, because part of my field is to look at film of artistic practice. So I have a film expert as part of my panel, but from a different department. So these are kind of, you know, you apply to one person, but when you put together this panel, you'll obviously be looking at the whole school for whoever's got the expertise.
And also another point that is quite important to raise as well is for those of you that don't quite manage to get a funded scholarship within the university, then it's not quite the end of the world. No. I'm not funded, I'm self-funded, and have to spend parts of my week working part-time as well, which a lot of other students do that are also on a full-time course. And people just, you just get used to balancing the workload. We have other students that have two young children, or, you know, children and jobs and the research. I'm supposed to finish in 3 years, but I might take the extra year to finish writing up. So don't feel too pressured that, you know, you can't balance and juggle lots and lots of things, because it is possible. It's just sometimes a way of structuring your week around, you know, different work and jobs. So that's also something to think about as well.
Well, this dialogue you're supposed to start. You're supposed to start a dialogue with an academic, yeah, and they will know pretty much straight away.
Cause, well, they've said pretty similar, actually.
There's nothing much.
Some stuff coming from America, but not from Britain.
I think as well, in your first year, as you do more and more reading, there's always like a heart-stopping moment when you come across something that looks like your research. So then you just have to change direction. You usually go down a path where you've got like some wriggle room anyway. So.
Doing this, you will either find a job that's perfectly made for you, or you'll never find anything, because you are unique.
your supervisor together are going to have to map out your own research framework.
So it's quite acceptable on that proposal where it wants to know what's going on in the area to put not a lot.
Yeah, you can say there's very little research. You know, this is an emerging field. Therefore, I am aware I'm going to have to negotiate my own methodological framework here. And you say that. And one thing that might help you, by the way, is going part-time. You have 6 years now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing the MSc part-time.
Right, just as
I'm in
other questions about proposals, because that's like the you were just going to ask something, go on. Spoke to someone in my department who unfortunately was leaving, so she told me to go and have a word. Well, she recommended one other person in the department and another person in a department at Goldsmiths in London. So I applied at the same time with two different people. And then, so I met the staff member in Manchester and we kind of like had a dialogue. She said, yes, I would be interested in this. Write up your proposal, and then you kind of send them 1,000 words and they say, well, can you move this a little bit more because I think someone's already done this, and then you send that off for your application, and then you use the same thing for your funding application. So but at all times you've got this kind of backwards and forwards, so you're already starting to work with this member of staff and you get to see whether you actually enjoy working with them and get to know whether you think you'll be able to go for 3 years with them. If you suddenly realise you're not getting on, it's probably a warning sign that you might not be able to handle 3 years with the same person. So Lucy's a supervisor, but yeah, let's go.
Well, to just go back to how I started this process, I was on the Master's Art History course and was studying full time and was just working through the deadlines and just trying to get through the MA course, and I didn't even think about what would happen when I finished. I didn't even attend a session like this as to what would happen if I were to, you know, the PhD was just never considered. I was on, I studied one of Emma's early Christian modules, and in one of one of the sessions we were looking at Byzantine pilgrimage art, I came across an article and found this little reliquary in this like random article, and wrote my MA paper on it, and then decided to work with Emma for my dissertation for the MA over the summer. So again, we'd built up that relationship from master's level, and we'd worked together on my dissertation, and it was during the summer period before the September that I started that we started the conversation about studying for a PhD, and that's how it started, and I started that September. So it was very quick, and I hadn't thought about it at all like you all have. It just happened.
And there's another important point in there as well, because some people will tell you that your MA dissertation has to, like, you know, your PhD has to follow on from that, but like mine is based on an MA paper that I did briefly with this tutor that's now my supervisor, and the same with you. So,
yeah.
I mean, my MA dissertation is related. It's about photography and documentary, but you couldn't shoehorn my MA dissertation into as a chapter of my PhD because they're completely different areas. But
it won't be looked upon negatively from the supervisor or funding body.
No. I don't think so. As long as you can back up your knowledge. I mean, I had an MA dissertation that was about photography and about documentary, but it wasn't it was about 1930s English photography, and my stuff now is about 1950s American photography. So there's quite a leap, but. It's a good idea to underline, though, where your dissertation research fits in, how you've progressed. So mention all the things that are the same about it, but why you've moved in a different direction.
What inspired you to change direction?
Yeah.
I took intensive Syriac lessons in my first year of my PhD, and by the end of my PhD I could read the liturgy in Syriac, which is what I needed to do. You kind of need to build that in.
That held against you in an application?
No, but if you ask that, if you say I'm going to have to learn like four different languages, it would be. If it's learning one different language, fine. So it's what's realistic. And if do you have other languages? You're saying about learning Latin?
I was thinking,
because I was going to say, it's helpful if you can show a track record, because when I had A-levels in French and German, I'd studied Italian as an undergraduate, so I've kind of developed a track record of using other languages. So when I went in there and said, I'm going to learn Syriac in my first year, instead of laughing at me, they're like, well, this is someone who's got a background of learning languages, so it's not going to be a massive shock to the system. So it's quite good if you can, as Andy said, show a kind of thread going through. But learning a new skill like that is fine, as long as you don't say, I'm going to learn Hebrew, Latin, and Greek in my first year, in which case they'll just laugh. But one new language.
There are short courses on offer, though, as well. If you need to brush up, say, in your German or your French or your Italian, they're like summer courses, 6 weeks.
Intensive courses.
Yeah. So, like, written, you can learn written German, so rather than conversational, so you can get through a text. So.
But it is important. For example, I wouldn't have accepted Lucy to do her subject if it wasn't that she already read French and Italian. That meant that I was prepared to take up that subject. Lucy and I have a few more minutes, and then we have to go off because I'm supposed to be teaching at 2, but I'm sending Andy ahead to look after my first year's form.
If I can just change the topic a little bit, for those of you that are interested in teaching or moving on into academic work after the PhD, there are teaching opportunities presumably within most departments in this university. I help lead the seminars for first and second year undergraduates. You tend to take one module each semester, and I did that last year, and I'm doing it for 2 semesters this year. And again, that's, you know, it's a really interesting way of learning new skills. Again, looks great on the CV to say that you have experience of teaching at undergraduate level. And again, like I said, you learn lots of new skills through it. So that's something to consider as well.
How does that work? Do you have to ask to do that when you apply to say this is how I'm going to fund myself?
No.
You can't teach in your first year of a PhD, but in your first year of your PhD, you need to approach your dissertation supervisor and also the postgraduate supervisor for your subject area and get your name put down, because you have to take training courses before you're allowed to be let loose on the undergraduates. And so they're part of the SAGE program. You know, like this program, the arts methods that Andy was talking about, runs teaching classes. And you have to do so many GTA, graduate teaching assistant training classes, that you are then allowed to teach in your second and third year.
And does that pay, or is it balanced against your fees? Or
no, you're kind of given, you are paid, but...
There are certain bursaries, university bursaries, where you don't get paid for teaching because it's taken as being part of your bursary, but if you're self-funded and certain other bursaries, you do get paid.
Mm.
It's not a great deal, I'm afraid.
No.
Yeah. No, what I'm saying is it's not enough. No, it's great. I'm not taking it off like that, but it's not enough you can live off of. I just want people to know. It's nice to have, and it's definitely better than nothing, but it's not something that you can make a living from or will come anywhere near covering your fees. I just want to make that clear, that it's definitely any money you can earn is good, but don't think that you can pay your way through by being a teaching assistant, because you can't.
And it doesn't always necessarily reflect the hours or effort of work that you've put into those lesson planning and essay marking and the time spent doing various other jobs, so just bear that in mind as well.
It looks very high as an hourly rate, but bear in mind that the hourly rate is not the reality at all, because it's just the hours a week you are in a classroom, and as Lucy said, it's not the planning, the marking and everything else you have to do. Yeah.
No, you apply next year, this time next year. And in some ways, that's quite an advantage if you've done very well in your master's, because you've actually got a track record there. You've got your grades, and it's very easy for people to write a reference for you. So there is nothing held against you, or it just gives you that extra time, really, to get your paperwork together. But no, it doesn't have to be consecutive. You would need to get it in, the stuff in by, I think it'll probably be the 15th, it's always around the 15th of sort of February, March, year after. So that would be 2013, wouldn't it? Right, I think we're going to have to end it there because there are lots of people waiting to come in. But any questions about funding, anything else, remember the session, 2:02, 3 o'clock this afternoon. Right, thanks.
Thanks. All right. I hope it worked, because there were three of us and we did talk.